I've got Libby Laws with me, one-time supermodel and now DJ, broadcaster, chocolate maker and gentle scourge of the status quo. Can you hear me, Libby?
Yes, I can, loud and clear. How are you doing, Doc?
Doing very well, thank you very much. Thanks a lot for joining us. I know it's you've been very patient.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure, always a pleasure.
So have you always been a rowdy rebel, or were you quiet to start with?
Well, my parents have conflicting stories. My mum says I was a little horror, and my dad says that I was good until I was about 16.
Yeah, I think mine had come up with a similar answer to that question. What do you reckon?
I think I've probably always felt something's not right, and I've always not liked doing what I'm told. So I'd go with the since birth thing, really.
I guess probably been the best way to start with this world we find ourselves in. So did you, what did you do? What did you spend a lot of time in education, or did you get out as soon as you could?
I got out as soon as I could, definitely. I left school straight after my O-levels, and I did a year at drama college, and then I flunked out of that, really, and went off to be a model. So, yeah, I got a contract in Japan, and at 17 just got on a plane and went to Tokyo.
So you left home good and proper then?
Yeah, I did. Oh. No short measures here.
Well, I can think of many youngsters who decided to take that particular option one way or the other. Was modelling any more fun than being in the army or the police, which seems to be another way of leaving home effectively?
Well, I think at the time, I mean, looking back, I mean, I can see now how really that industry is pretty nasty. But at the time, I was so naive that I just had a great time. It was just fun. And, you know, when people told me what to do, I was happy to please people, really, because I was just thrilled at having that opportunity. But, I mean, I did get to this stage where people were saying, can we tape your ears back? I'm like, no. What, a big lump of gaffer tape behind my ears? No, I don't think so. Book someone with smaller ears. So, yeah, towards the end of it, I got a bit shirty with people. But in the beginning, yeah, I loved it. And I had a great 6 years, really, I did it for. And I can't say that I regret anything about it. It was all just really good fun.
What was it like going to Japan from the UK? Because that's pretty much of a culture shock, isn't it?
Well, yeah, especially then. I mean, it was what? It was, God, 86, 87, 86, I think, 1986. So, yeah, I mean, life there was very different. I went back every year, really, for about 6 weeks each year. And I could see the whole progression of difference in how it was. I mean, the first time I went there, there was no signs on the tube in English. It was really difficult to get around. We had to be chaperoned around. We had to meet at a certain place in tube stations and stuff like that, and then get chaperoned to the actual castings and stuff. I think the cultural difference really hits you when you come back more than when you go. It's just like, wow, look at this place. It's bright lights and just everything's, it's wow, you know. But then when you come back, that's when you notice the difference, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I've heard that said, because of course things have been changing pretty fast here over, you know, the last 20 years or so, and I'm told that you can really see the difference when you come back after time elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, probably the last time I went there, so what, 5 years later, so 86, what, about 90 91, by that time they had signs in English. There was a lot more Americans there definitely doing business. There was even more McDonald's and more Domino's pizzas and more Americans. Well, it was very much more Americanized, really. Yeah.
I guess they are making the whole thing a lot more uniform, isn't it? Because, I mean, we might not have signs in Japanese here, but what we've got is lots of pictures so that people from all over the world can understand things.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it was very different. But, I mean, going over there as a model, you're kind of protected in a way that your agency, you're under the umbrella of your model agency, so you're basically stuck there, and they do rip you off. I mean, you're given a contract for either $10,000 for so many weeks or $15,000, whatever your base agency has arranged for you, and you generally do come out with that money. But I mean, there was one job that I went to, and they found out that I found out that I'd been paid a lot more than what I'd actually took home, and the agency just skim it off. And then they'll go, oh, well, you know, it was this and it was that and this meal and that meal and this, you know, and it's just like, I'm being ripped off and there's nothing really you can do about it. So you just take the money that you get and be grateful that you've got anything, really.
Not much different from the music industry there, then.
No, I doubt it. No, I mean, the funny thing is as well, it always used to make me laugh was when you worked in England, I don't know if it's still the same now, but then it was the agencies here would take 15%. Which I thought was decent for the job that they did. When you went abroad, it was 20%. So you had this extra 5% that they just paid your taxes with. And then when I went to Milan, it was 25%. And I said, where's this extra 5% going? And it was to the mafia. And then I'm like, I don't want to pay the mafia. And they're like, you've got no choice. That's that.
So was that where it started to get a bit ropey for you?
Well, that, I mean, the drugs got me in Milan, really, because I started seeing a guy that was not really... it was all just in the clubs, and they have these... they're called PR agents, and they work in the nightclubs. And it wasn't until I came back and I saw a Donald McIntyre documentary about it. And basically, all these PR guys, they hang out in the bars and cafes near the model agencies, and they escort you out to lunch, and then they say, oh, why don't you come to my club tonight? So you're escorted into a nightclub and you're put in this sort of VIP area. Now, what was going on, I never clocked it at the time, because one of the guys that I was going out with was one of these PR guys, so I guess in a way that I was protected by that, thankfully. But what happens is that there's a lot of very rich men in this VIP area as well, and you're introduced to them and they take you outside for a line of coke or whatever you're into, and then you're expected to go home and shag them, basically, and they're paying these PR guys, so you're actually being pimped out without even being aware of it. So Milan is pretty sick in that way.
It sounds like a little more nor less than a meat market, really.
Well, yeah, that's exactly what it is. So, yeah, I mean, I never really... I knew something was going on, but I could never actually place my finger on it. And the more Italian that I learnt, the more I was kept out of like, the discussions that were going on, and no one was ever, like, I never quite got what was going on. But, yeah, when I came back and I saw this documentary and I knew practically every bloke in there, I was like, oh, my God, that's what was going on, you know. So, go on.
That must have been quite interesting to see a documentary on a subject where you recognise all the people, because presumably the documentary was revealing the nature of the marketplace, was it?
Yeah, I was like, fucking hell, this is really bad. And I knew all these people, and I was just like, and they'd pinpointed a couple of people, which I wasn't exactly, there was two or three teams of these guys working for various clubs. So the team of guys that I was with, sort of the guy that I was going out with, he worked in this one club, and so I became very good friends with these guys. And like, I'd picked up a few things, like, oh, all the models are whores, all the models are prostitutes, and I could never work out why they had this attitude. So then when it all fell into place, but there was another team that were a lot more ruthless, and they'd pinpointed that team rather than the team of guys that I knew. So I was grateful, really, that I wasn't in with the very bad team, to be honest.
It must have been a hell of a realisation, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I was shocked. I just caught this programme. I was on my way out one night, and I just caught this programme, and I saw models in Milan. So I just sat down to have a quick look at it. And I missed the night I was going out to, because I just got engrossed in this programme. And then afterwards, they said, if you've been affected by this programme, call this number. So I phoned them up. It was on the BBC, and I phoned them up, and they did. They called me back the next day and asked me lots of questions, and I didn't kind of feel like I should drop all these people in it. But on the other hand, what they were doing was very underhand and very sick. And there's a lot of very young girls out there. So, yeah, I just had a big conversation with people and said that I knew these guys. And no, most models weren't aware of what was going on over there. Maybe a couple had sussed it. But generally, all the models were totally unaware of what was going on.
It's quite interesting, that, isn't it? That something that once you know about it, I guess it must have been really difficult to miss. But until you did know about it, it all looked like just another business.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I guess most of the women are young girls, aren't they? Do you get many mature ladies, shall we say, taking part?
No, I mean, on average, I mean, in some places like Japan and stuff, they send girls out, I'd say 13, 14. But generally in Milan, the average age of the girl was probably about 19, 18, 19. So, yeah, still pretty young, you know, and probably no older than 26. I mean, generally speaking, once you're 23, you're over the hill in the modelling industry, unless you're a big name.
Yeah, and I guess by then you found out what's going on and are either chosen to cooperate or not.
Yeah, quite. Or bail out.
So what did you do at that point? Because, you know, this I guess, had been your means of earning since you left home, and I guess you didn't particularly want to go home. So what did you do? What was your response to this?
Well, I mean, that I didn't see that programme until after I'd stopped. It was a couple of years after I'd stopped modelling, so... I mean, what stopped me modelling was there was a lot of drugs involved. I spent 3 years in Milan total, and that was like my last 3 years. I got very unhappy there. I came back to England. I did a TEFL thing, teaching English as a foreign language. I went back to Italy. I taught English for about another year. And then I came back to England, had a bit of a holiday really, and then just, I set up a shop. I worked for my dad in a bicycle shop for a while. And then I set up my own clothes shop. I did that for another year and then got bored, so bored of just being in the shop, I just packed the whole thing up. And
did it work for you, the shop thing, apart from it being boring? Was it a successful venture?
Well, yeah, it was actually. It was a bit silly to shut it because it was just getting to the stage where I was getting a name for myself, because I'd found a really good wholesaler where the people you could design stuff, and there was a big organization of, I think they were Indian brothers, and they got some people in India, and you could send them little drawings and stuff. So they'd make it for you. So I got to design a few little pieces here and there. And so, yeah, I got known to have quite original stuff. And I seem to have the eye for what people wear. And I think being in the fashion industry had helped that anyway. But yeah, I mean, financially, I don't think I lost anything. But then I didn't have to pay rent because my dad owned the shop. So
yeah, it definitely gives you a bit of the breather, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think if I'd have paid rent, I probably wouldn't have done that well. But without paying the rent, it was all right. We broke even most weeks.
You know, I think that that's probably still true for most people. If we didn't have to pay the rent or the mortgage, we'd probably be doing reasonably okay.
Yeah, absolutely. Although my dad was threatening, right, you've done it a year now, you're going to have to start paying rent. Okay, let's go away for a while, shall we?
It sounds like a fairly versatile approach to life. You sound like you've kind of rolled with the punches, as it were.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think I have. I've just, you know, if you create a situation and it doesn't work out for you, then you've just got to deal with that shit, haven't you? Really. So I'm quite good at accepting that I've created an issue, so I've got to deal with it. I don't shirk from my self-responsibilities too often, and I don't think I ever have. So, yeah, I mean, if I've had enough, I'm just like, right, let's pack everything up. Do I owe anybody money? If I do, then I have to pay them off. Generally, I don't think I've ever left debts behind. And then, yeah, just I went off then. I went to Greece for about a year and a half. So, yeah, I just went travelling and working in bars and stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it's all good. It's all good. I mean, I did have some ups and downs and, like, some heartbreaks and, you know, but generally that period of my life was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun. My main search in life during my 20s was looking for fun.
Yeah,
and that's what I did, and I did have a lot of fun. Can't deny that.
I think it's another important point that, especially in the current climb, that this idea of knowing when to move on is quite an interesting skill to have. It's the same thing happened to me broadly every three and a half years. I find that things are really great and manageable when you first start them, and then they slowly change. But yeah. I know lots of people who haven't been able to let go. But it, for me, it's always worked out. When I've decided something's not for me anymore, the next thing, even if I didn't know what it was when I moved, has always turned out to be even more interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I just think when your heart's not in something anymore, there's no point in doing it. And that was the stage I got to with modelling. So, yeah, I just packed up from Milan and came back to England. Again, with the shop, I just wasn't, you know, it was a drag to get out of bed every morning and go there and be there at a certain time every day, day in, day out. And I just thought, I don't want to be doing this in my 20s. I want to be having fun.
Yeah. You know?
So, yeah, I mean, my dad always said it was a little bit stupid and other people said it was brave. So I think I ride that fine line between being brave and stupid.
Yeah, exactly the same thing was said to me. They said they expect, you know, people expect to see a steady development in your CV. They don't want to see you hopping around the place. But, of course, in the years since, we now see people that are on kind of 6 and 9 month rolling contracts or 0 hours contracts or all of these other things. And in the end, I think that everybody's boffing around a bit now.
Yeah, well, I don't think there's, I mean, there's certainly not that job security that we were told we would have when we left school. That just doesn't exist, does it? You know, and what also makes me very cross about proper jobs is that you're expected to do overtime for no extra money nowadays. What, when did that happen? You know, it's like, oh, well, it's because we're in a creative industry and you've got to stay until the job's done, or it's just because, oh, it's like, no, fuck off. If you're working past your 9 to 5, why aren't you being paid overtime?
Because that's the main reason that you're there. I mean, if you're lucky, you enjoy what you're doing as well, but no point in trying to take more of your time without giving you any extra gaming tokens for it.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, and people just seem to comply with that, where, I mean, I don't think I'm a particularly employable person either, so, which I'm quite proud about, I hasten to add. But, I mean, for example, when I was in Greece, travelling around there and working in bars, I think within 6 months I'd had over 18 jobs, you know, just because I'm like, not doing that, no, I can't do that. It's like, right, well, we'll find someone that will.
Yeah. Did you come across any jobs that you did like, that you did enjoy?
Well, I don't have any problem with working behind a bar or waitressing, to be honest. I actually really like it because you get to meet loads of people, and I kind of thrive a little bit on that stress of like, right, I've got 10 tables and their dinners, and like weighing it all up in your mind as whose dinner's going to be ready first and making sure that the service is all. I find that quite an enjoyable challenge. And plus you're meeting people, and if you're nice and chatty to people, you can come out of it quite well at the end of the evening. So yeah, I enjoyed doing anything really where I meet a lot of people. I think that's part of it, is just getting on and chatting with people.
Yeah, yes, I would agree with that, and seem to get a lot more of that done not having a regular job.
Absolutely.
So when did you start getting a bit suspicious about the rest of the system that we find ourselves occupying? What was it that started raising eyebrows with you?
Well, just when I came back to England as well, and I worked for my dad for a short amount of time, and I didn't like having to pay tax. So because I was working for my dad, I was like, look, how do we not pay tax? And he was like, well, you've got to kind of buckle into the system to make the system win for you. And I just didn't agree with that at all. It just felt wrong. And I just remember having a conversation with my dad as well, saying, something's not right. I don't know what it is, but something's not right. And I had that feeling looking back now. I'd had that feeling since I was a child that something wasn't right. And I think probably in my late 20s was what I was quite determined to try and find out what it was, because I was still feeling it. But yeah, I don't think it was till my late 30s that I started to go through the wake-up period. And then it was when I read David Icke's The Biggest Secret, when I read all about the corporation of the UK, and then it all just fell into place, and I was like, right, that's what I've been looking for. That's the rip-off. That's the scam that I've been feeling. So, yeah. Probably late for, well, I was about 32, 33.
Yeah, I know there's a lot of things said about David Icke, but without doubt he has woken a lot of people up, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I think as well in those early years for him, I mean, from my point of view, I was really grateful to him for being able to write it all down in a way that we could read it. I mean, whatever's gone on since then and what's gone on with him recently, I'm not too sure about him and his actions, to be honest. But, I'm grateful for that, that he did that at that time, that was probably the first era of people waking up, wasn't it?
I think it was. I think for our generation, it does seem very much to happen in the kind of the mid to late 30s as well. Somebody once said to me, it's not that life begins at 40, it's just that that's when you notice that there's something going on.
Well, I think I've realised before I was 40, but I mean, for me, when I turned 40, life did begin for me in a way, because that was the point for me when I'd left my children's dad and I was doing things for myself and for my children. So that was kind of the beginning of me really becoming me and the person that I am now. So yeah, 40 for me was great. 45, which is a few months ago, it's like, that was a bit of a, I think I might need to go and get Botox or something. But now I'm over that now. So yeah, I think 40 is a good age because you've got that clarity. And 40 is as well, if you don't know what you really want to do, 40 is the point where you go, right, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I want to do, and you get on and do it, and you've got that focus, and you've got all the wank fuckery out of the way, you know, with the drinking and the drugs and the partying and all the rest of it. That's you've done all that. So, yeah, then you can really focus in on what you want to do.
And it is a matter of following your heart, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, I wouldn't disagree on that at all.
So did you? How did you find it? Because again, there's a tendency in this society, for want of a better word, for partners to become separate, as it were, and for one of the individuals to end up with the children. How did you find that? Because I always knew that I never wanted children, and when I was a youngster, people were going, "Oh, you know, you'll change your mind and stuff." But I figure, looking at it, it must be much harder dealing with this system when you've actually got children.
It is, because I think if I didn't have children, I'd probably be right out there on the front line, you know, waving cameras in people's faces and megaphones around cities and stuff. I would really be out there. Because I've got children, I don't feel that I can be in that, putting myself on the risk of being arrested regularly because of them. So I have to hold back a little bit. And I felt kind of torn for a year or so when was it, 2009, probably, when there was like another really sort of big awakening. And that was when it was like, boom, I'm totally clear on what's going on now. So, yeah, I think if I didn't have children, life would be very different for me. But I have got children and they're absolutely adorable. And the best that I can do really is to teach them, as they grow up, about the life that they live in. But I don't want to separate them too much from society because I don't want them to grow up being totally alienated. So I think to teach them about what's going on but still let them integrate on a certain level, they'll grow up healthily with a healthy, mindful attitude, and they'll be able to sit and they won't have to go through that wake up because they'd have been brought up knowing that something's not right.
Do you find signs that they've got some of this material sort of, because I'm meeting lots of young people who know more than I do. Some of them have spent a lot more time looking at it as well. Do you see anything in your youngsters that suggests that they might already be somewhat rebellious?
Oh, God, yeah. I think, well, having me as a mother and who their father is as well, we're both rebels. So, yeah, how could they not be, really? And cheeky as anything. I mean, they've got cheeky from me and then just even more cheeky from their dad. So they've got double cheeky in their genes. My daughter especially, I think she's going to be quite a character when she grows up. I mean, my little boy, he's quite spiritual and he's very sensitive and aware of what people are feeling and what's going on around him. Whereas my daughter, I think she's going to be quite a force to be reckoned with. She's very determined. And once she sets her mind to do something, she'll get it, whatever ways or means. Or, you know, if she can't get something through me, she'll find another way to get it. You know, she's very, very focused and determined. And I think for a young girl to be brought up in the society we're living in now, I can only think that that's a good thing, you know. So, yeah.
And are they going to school, or do you teach them yourself?
They were going to school until last September. I pulled them out about 2 weeks into the new school year last September. I just had enough of the system. I couldn't buckle down to it myself. I lost trust in the school. I lost faith in them. Well, not all of the teachers. Some of the teachers there were really good, a couple of them. However, the headmaster and you know, the way that Common Purpose is infiltrating into the schools, I could see it and the headmaster couldn't, and we were just at loggerheads over it. And I just felt I'd lost trust in him, and I didn't want to leave my children with anybody I didn't trust. So I've pulled them out. My daughter has asked to go back to school, and I won't stop her from doing that. Fortunately, there's no places for her at the moment. I wouldn't send her back to that school. We've looked at another school which is more in line with my thinking. So I'd be happy for her to go there. I think she just misses out on little girl friendships, really. So I am working quite hard to make sure that she still has those friendships even though she's not in school.
Yeah, is that made easy where you live to socialise outside a school environment and do that sort of thing? Have you got a lot of home educating and stuff around there?
Yeah, it's actually quite good. There's in the town, I'm just outside of Bristol, in Clevedon, there is a new home education group just set up recently, so I need to tap into that one. And I've been going to Bristol. I mean, it's only 20 minutes away. And there's loads going on in Bristol. There's free running, there's ice skating, there's loads of sport-based things for the younger kids. And then the older kids, they link up with the universities and they can go in and do things with the university there. So, yeah, there is loads going on. And I think it's more diverse than just being stuck in a classroom. I mean, going into a university and picking the brains of a university professor as a teenager, I think would be a lot more interesting than just sitting listening to some teacher going, what, copy this off the blackboard.
Yeah, I think you're right. And it was always a bit of a shock for my generation, basically just went from one thing to the next thing. And the next thing was always substantially different from the thing you'd done before. So from, I don't know, what they used to call primary school to secondary school to university. And it seemed to me that the rug was permanently out from under your feet.
Yeah. I mean, I struggled at school. I didn't really like school. I just, I think as long as my children can read and write and do basic maths and then whatever they show an interest for, obviously they show a lot of interest for Minecraft, which is slightly disturbing, but then it's also very creative on another hand. So, I mean, I think I struggle daily in that, am I doing the right thing? Am I doing them a disservice? I mean, that crosses my mind every single day, and I don't want to do them a disservice. I want them to get the best. But having seen how much happier they are, how much more confident they are, and they've just come out of themselves as real little people, I can't knock what I've done, really. I can't say I've made a mistake because I've seen them come out of themselves as little people. So I think I've done the right thing.
Yeah, that must be tremendously exciting.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, I talk to other home ed parents regularly, and people that have been doing it have never sent their children to school. Even they have wobbles, you know, and it's this cognitive dissonance that we're struggling with, that you must go to school, otherwise you will not be educated. There are other ways of educating, and because we're the first generation that are really doing this, that a lot more than when I was a kid, for example. It was a really small percentage then. There's a much bigger percentage of kids being home-edded now. I think it is going to be scary, you know, but life's a skateboard. You know, sometimes you get off and scuff your elbows and your knees, don't you? You've just got to pick yourself up and deal with it.
That's quite often where you learn most, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I'm not shy of asking for help if I really think I need it. So I've got quite a decent little network around me.
I guess the best thing you can do is make sure that that the alternative ideas get in, as well as the ideas that are being inculcated by the no fit state. Because I mean, it's come as, I think, one of the biggest shocks that I've had in my awakening is the realization of just how much bunkum history is as taught. You know, that effectively I've realized that my head was filled with loads of stuff that was presented as facts that, in fact, appear to be at best matters of opinion.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I loved history at school. I loved it. And, yeah, now I feel quite cross about it because it's like, oi, there's a load of bullshit. Why are you teaching me bullshit? You know, but then I mean, it's like what David Icke calls teachers, he calls them repeaters, doesn't he? They're just repeating what they think they know, and that it's in that system and it's just rolling over into each generation. So, yeah, I think we are the generation where we're breaking the rules and saying no and trying to change things, even in little ways. You know, we're all fighting against something for things to be better.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that's really I've noticed coming up since the beginning of 2014 is some of our more famous voices really saying, you know, the time for action has actually come now, and that really, if we're not going to feel the jackboot on our throats, then we really need to start sorting things out. I mean, Truth Juice Dave is saying that the time for action is now. I know Vin was on talking with Sean last night. He was having a good
rant, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, and it's really great to hear, because I think there is a kind of sense of urgency now. And I'm, you know, I've been, since really, well, for quite some time, I've been wondering how best to start getting ideas out to people who don't seem to be really willing to take them on, even though I think most people by now must have something of an uneasy feeling about what's happening to all their money. And I would have thought that if people knew what was happening to children in the schools, that would be one of the best ways of waking them up.
Yeah, I mean, I've found good ways of talking, of getting through to people that you wouldn't term as awake, either through food or the common law and the taxes and the council tax being a rip-off and stuff like that. Because tax, I mean, like we said earlier, who likes paying tax? No one likes paying tax. I did actually have a funny conversation with one of the tax guys a couple of weeks ago, actually, and I phoned up the tax office and I said, what happens if you don't want to pay tax? And he's like, well, you have to pay tax. And I said, why do we have to pay tax? He goes, because that's the law. And I said, yeah, but who made up that law? He goes, well, the government. And I said, yeah, but I don't agree with paying law, because I've discovered it's either 83% or 87% of everyone's tax money goes to killing people in foreign countries that I don't agree with. So can I just pay you the 13% that goes for the roads and the whatever? And he was just like totally baffled. He'd never heard it. It was just like, will not function. Do you know what I mean? So yeah, it was quite amusing. I should have recorded it, shouldn't I?
Because you do. That's one of the things I really like about you, is that you do take the game to these individuals, don't you?
I can't help it. Yeah, I mean, one way one thing that I do a lot is I write on fivers. I think fivers and £10 notes are a currency that get passed around more frequently, given in change and stuff. So fivers are a good one. Just put messages on it. Look up, we're being sprayed. Google Monsanto, your food is poison. Just like all these little messages. just sowing seeds.
I think that's a great idea, actually, making something useful out of the fake money.
Yeah, just like scribble on it.
So I guess that would be one of... It does seem to me to be a pretty sound approach to... Because really, in a way, it's the man who doesn't understand that you don't have to pay tax, that there's a man that's really got to be convinced of it, isn't it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just for example, there's a mechanic who deals with my car, and I was talking to him. I mean, he thinks it's great. He thinks it's hilarious, but he's not brave enough to do it himself. Because you do it first, and then I'll do it. So, I mean, I'm not in the position where I'm paying tax, thankfully, at the moment. So it would be very interesting to see what would happen, because if I were to do it and then go to him and say, look, I've done this, this is the outcome, blah, 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 then let's see if he follows suit. And then if he follows suit, let him tell some of his friends, because tax is what's killing people, really, financially. Tax and mortgage, isn't it? So
that's certainly where a lot of the money seems to go. I know that the Litmus, who joined me a couple of weeks ago for a chat, actually had some success with DVLA, pointing out to them, I think by means of a notice, that he wasn't paying their tax, because even if that was a small crime, he was preventing a bigger crime by so doing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when I talked to Albert Burgess, he was saying he's got this website where you can download loads of information and put it onto a CD all about treason. And if you go into a police station and say, hand in the CD and say, I wish to report a crime of treason and sedition, hand it in, If that police station won't act on it, then go to another police station and say, I want to report this police station for not acting upon a crime, until you get lots of police stations involved in it. And then once you've got the crime number that from reporting the crime, you can then go to the tax office and say, I'd like to become tax exempt because of the treason that's being committed, and I'm not paying, I don't want to be a part of that. And he said that some people have had success that way, so that could be a good way. I don't know anybody that's done that, but if you want to get in touch with Albert Burgess, I know he's on Facebook. He was an ex-copper, and he's not happy about things, so.
And that's really one of the keys, isn't it, is getting to people who are still or who have been part of the control mechanism, because they've, if nothing else, they seem to be slightly more trusted voices.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I've tried talking to soldiers, I've tried talking to policemen, and my experience of police people is they're in the same situation. They've got to go to work, that's their job, they need to pay their mortgage, they've got to support their families. The decent ones anyway, the ones that are just thugs, I don't even bother talking to because I don't see the sense in it. They just get angry and it gets scary. But yeah, there are some decent coppers still left, and if you can get through to them. I mean, I had an incident not long ago and I ended up talking to this one copper, and he had been sent off to look after the activists that were involved in the badger cull. And he said, I don't agree with it. I don't agree with the culling of badgers. I've got a personal conflict going on because I don't agree with it, you know. So you could see, like, this dilemma going on in the guy's head. But, again, he was stuck in a job that had to pay a mortgage and had to pay tax and the rest of it. So, you know, it's how to break out of that system without losing your home and not being able to support your family. It's a scary thing.
Yeah, I guess so. That's a kind of a stick that's constantly held over us, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fortunate enough in that I've sort of weedled my way around the system, and just sort of, all right, I've never really had loads of money, but I've weedled around it in that I've never earned so much that I'm having to pay tax. I've never earned less than that I'm not comfortable. Do you know what I mean? So you can just sort of weedle by, and I kind of want to just stay under the radar a little bit doing that for a while and see as it pans out. But
seems to be working tolerably well.
Well, yeah, I'm getting by, so, and I'm comfortable at the moment. I'm not in debt. I'm not, you know, I haven't got bailiffs knocking at the door, so I'm keeping it all at bay at the moment. So, yeah.
And I would assume that any bailiffs that did turn up would be given an interesting conversation.
Yes, and a camera in their face too. Yeah.
So how goes the music?
The music's going well, thank you. Music. DJing, it's a passion. I love it. I've got to that stage now in my mixing where I feel comfortable enough with my actual beat mixing that I can really now muck around with big long mixes and pulling the EQs out and certain sounds out. So I'm having a lot of fun with it. And I'm just getting to the point where I found what I want to sound like. So yeah, if you want to hear what I sound like, there's a thing up on Mixcloud, Libby Laws. And yeah, I love it. It's a passion. I like making people dance, and I like that feeling that I'm raising energies. I'm raising energy levels and yeah, let's have it, you know. So that's a good feeling. I don't get to play out as often as I'd like to. But I'm sure that will come if I keep pushing in the right direction. But I've done a remix for Gary Clayle. That's being released in America in the next couple of weeks. So let's see how that pans out.
I'll be playing a half hour mix of yours to play the show out with, because I really enjoy it. I still don't really know what's going on. I mean, do you make all of the noises and the beats and everything and then mix them together, or are you using other people's stuff too?
No, I'm using other people's records and I mix them together. The mix that you're going to play, I did last year. That was the one that I was giving away at Green Gathering. I'd say I've probably improved a lot in the last year. I think I sound a lot better now than I did last year. Yeah, but generally I'm using other people's records. But it's when you mix two records together And if you can hold the mix down so that they're not falling out of sync, and then you're pulling out this swoosh from one record and that ksh from another record, and, you know, that's how you really create. So you're making your own music with other people's records, basically. And that's what I'm doing.
And do you think, I mean, I've always felt that there's probably quite a solution in music, and again, you get a bit jaded once you realise what the music industry actually is, but I still feel sure that in the music and the dancing, there's hope for us, don't you?
Well, absolutely. I mean, dancing raises energies. It makes people feel good. I mean, I have a dance most days, and it always makes me feel good. If I feel miserable, I'll put on some really loud music and just dance, and I always feel better afterwards. I've really got that thing. I mean, I came from the beginning of house music, so dance music is my thing. It's the thing that makes my toes tap, and it I just feel it. So I want to share that with everybody. I know and I understand that not everyone likes dance music. Poor you, but never mind.
one of the things I've noticed about dance music, well, I guess like all other music, there is some really, really cracking stuff that you're not likely to hear if you're only listening to mainstream radio. And there's also a whole lot of dross, which is probably what they will put on the mainstream radio.
Yeah, I mean, buying records as well. I have to trudge through listening to a lot of records, but now I'm getting more astute at it. And within 10 seconds, I know if I like that record or if I'd play that record or not. So you can just go on to the next one. So, yeah, there's a lot of dross out there. But then, you know, if some people like dross, then that's up to them, isn't it? That's their thing. If that makes them tick, then there's something for everybody. I think that's the thing with dance music. There is something for everybody, whether it's chill out or what I call Ibiza shishi music, or like drum and bass or old school. Or, I mean, I mostly play breaks or progressive, so I'm quite aggressive on the decks as well. So yeah, there's something for everybody within dance music. I mean, even my parents like the ambient music that I play, for instance. You know, I mean, that to me is just classical music with a beat underneath it. So yeah, I mean, it's got such a varying. The whole genre of dance music is massive, with loads of mini genres in between. So you can always find something you like, I'm sure.
And so what sort of places do you browse for your records? Do you actually go to a physical record shop and play them, or have you got preferred places you seek it out on the net?
The days of record shopping mostly are over now, I think. That's what I used to do. I mean, there were some fabulous record shops. My favourite one used to be a record shop called Massive, which they have one in Birmingham and one in Oxford. And they had nice stalls, loads of decks, and they'd have a pile of records ready for you and go, here, you might like this, and then you'd work your way through it. Nowadays, I'll always go to Beatport first. They seem to have taken over the internet record shops, but there's Juno Records, DJ Download, and then there's lots of bands as well that just put up their own music on their own sites, and I try and support them as much as possible because they're not going through the big record labels or Amazon or iTunes or whatever. So, I'll always check out the bands that I like on their personal web pages and see if they've got stuff for downloads, which most of them have, and buy it straight from the artist.
And then do you let them know that you're using it?
A couple of them, yeah. I mean, I interviewed Mike Tournier as my last hippie punk show, and he's been one of my musical heroes for a long time. So, yeah, it was a big honour to interview him. And, I'd sent him a mix that I'd done of one of his records. And sometimes you just get records and they just fit and it just sounds amazing. I sent him this mix and he liked it. So I was like, yeah, he liked it. So, yeah, it always, I don't do it with everybody. But yeah, my favourite musical artist, I think, why not get in touch with them and say, yeah, I love your stuff and I'm playing it and this is how it ends up sounding. What do you think? You know?
I guess that's a good way of spreading your name about a bit. And it looks to me like you know what you're doing, because the first time I became aware of you was, I think, at that Green Gathering you just mentioned, when the whole of our crew disappeared and went dancing to your set. I've never seen them quite so excited all in one place, actually.
That was something quite special that night, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was it, because I didn't know a lot of those people then. I think I knew of them, but I didn't really know. I knew Dave. I didn't really know a lot of them. So now I've become really good friends with a lot of that crew. And hopefully this summer, I've been booked again to play there this summer, and I'll be camping with you lot. So, yeah, let's have some fun again this summer, absolutely.
Oh, that'd be really good having you camping amongst us, because the Avalon Rising crew is always interesting, because most of our hosts and speakers camp with us as well.
Yeah, sure. That's why I said to you, can I camp with you lot this year?
I gather that the Green Gathering tickets this year are going faster than they've ever done before. I think their perseverance is finally paying off.
Brilliant, because they deserve it. It's a lovely little festival. It really is. You know, and it always impresses me. There's no proper electric there. It's all green. And that, God, what blew my mind away was when I walked down in between the two dance stages and they've got this massive, great big lorry with all the solar panels. That was like, whoa, this is where all the power's coming from. It just blew my mind. I was really impressed, because like most festivals, you hear the whirring of the generators at the back of the tents, don't you? But this, no, it was brilliant.
Yes, I like that, particularly like that aspect of the Green Gathering. I mean, for those of us who are doing presentations normally towards the end of the day, it does mean we quite often have to, well, certainly not last year. We had loads of electricity last year because I think it was a sunnier year. But quite often we end up doing our talks without pictures, which means a lot of description.
Well, I haven't got a problem with getting on a bike and pedalling for power. I think that's quite good fun, you know, if you can get that rig set up. I'd always be there pedalling to hear people talk or get them playing music or stuff. I think that's hilarious. You're sitting there and then, Green Man one year, they got six bikes and they got some DJs and they said, we'll play as long as you pedal. And it was really good fun because we like everyone slow down and just listen to the record go, and then like start pedalling really fast again.
It's amazing how much power a few people on pedal bikes can do. I've seen a couple of stages in my time where the lights and the music are all being powered by members of the audience on bicycles.
Yeah, it's great. And it gets audience participation and it breaks down barriers and releases inhibitions, and it just creates a lovely atmosphere. So, yeah.
Do you think the festivals have changed over the last few years? Did you go to any when you first got involved in dance music?
I didn't go to some of the early ones. I wish I had now, but I was always abroad travelling in the summer. I never wanted to stay in England in the summer, so I did kind of miss out on the festival thing. I think the first festival I went to really was probably 2001, which was Glastonbury. And I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I just felt this is the place where I want to be. And for the last 5 years as well, I've been involved in Green Man. One of my friends is the coordinator for the children's area. And so, yeah, I've been involved with Green Man, and that's just brilliant. I mean, last year was probably the best out of the 5 years that we've done. It just rocked. And one of my friends came down to see me at the festival before he went off travelling, and he said, you just are in your element here, aren't you? This is your place. Because you're just smiling the whole time. And I'm like, yeah, it's great, you know. And it is. I think being involved in the backstage parts of festivals is where it's at, really, because you don't have to pay for the tickets. You're doing things. There's stuff going on. And you're with loads of mates. And I just think getting involved in helping out is a lot more fun than being a punter.
I think that's exactly right, and it's something that that me and Synchro have been working towards for 2 or 3 years, and indeed, you know, the Avalon Rising crew is encouraging people to discover that, because at the moment it seems that, you know, it's like everything else, an enormous amount of effort goes into festivals, preparing them and when they're running, from volunteers. So they might get their ticket for the festival and stuff, but they are going to spend at least half of their time rushed off their feet. And it's always struck me that if people understood that if they don't drop the litter in the first place, other people won't have to pick it up. And that, you know, the kitchen, if like at the Beltane gig that's coming up or the Earth Dance last year, if you're going to be feeding, I don't know, 150, 200, 250, 300 people out of a kitchen, then it's really helpful to have a few people wielding knives first thing in the morning. And yep. that transformed festivals for me was when we realised what you've just described, that actually being part of it rather than just being there spending money is so much more fun.
Yeah, absolutely. There's that real feeling of community, isn't it? And I think that's it brings people together. I mean, from the Beltane last year where I met you, since then I've met so many wonderful people just through that festival. And yeah, we've created a community. We might not all be living in each other's pockets, but I know there's at least 10 people that I can phone up and go, "Oi, what's going on?" Or, "I need help," or, "Are you okay?" Or, you know, there's that unity. We've made that bond.
You see, I suspect that this is one of the points that's really worthy of notice is that if the law of opposite supplies, which we're told it does, then somewhere to balance the increasing shadow, there is an increasing light, and it's up to us to discover that, really. And I really get that from the small festivals, especially over the last couple of years. They seem to me to have really changed, and I agree. I meet dozens of really amazing people who are doing amazing things at them, and I'd really like to encourage people, because they're not expensive to get into. I think the Beltane Unity gig is £60 or £80, but it's for 5 days, and it's possible by volunteering to chip that down a little bit. But I find it very difficult. Actually, it's where I concentrate a lot of my effort, is rather than trying to tell people about the money and the banks and stuff, which they just don't seem to want to listen to. I'm trying to emphasise some of the positive sides of the things that we're doing, and the festivals. Hopefully, I'll be seeing more of my friends at them this year as a result.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I know I went to Sunrise a couple of years ago, and there was this one tent. It was an Indian restaurant tent, and the food was lush anyway. But they'd got a sign outside saying, if you want to work in the kitchen for a couple of hours, you'll get a free meal. So for anyone that's struggling with money, go and meet some people and chop some onions for a couple of hours, you know, or wash some dishes and get involved. All right, it's not everybody's cup of tea, but it's still fun if you're with people and you're having a laugh, you know. I don't mind getting my hands dirty and digging in for a short period of time and making it fun.
Yeah, I quite agree. And it does have to be said that one of the major expenses at festivals can be the food. So if you can assure yourself of you know, if you're getting a free meal anyway, and you can earn another one by doing a bit of work, then you can sort of see how the thing transforms itself. I think the biggest realisation I had was when we were crewing at the Dragon Fest in Spain, and I partied hard for 5 days because it's a bit of a riot, that festival, and actually came out with more gaming tokens than I went in, and that was a real transformational moment for me.
Yay! Yeah, well, I don't think I'm going to come out with more than I went in, but I'll have to see if I can pull that one off this year.
Well, you've got your chocolate and stuff now. How's the chocolate making going?
Yeah, all right. I'll be having a big making session this week, actually. I've got a new market starting on Thursday. So there's a brand new market in Bristol down at Temple Quay from 11:30 till 2 o'clock. Yeah, it's just food, so I'll be there peddling my wares. So yeah, I've got a great big session of chocolate making. I've had new labels done. My little packets are looking quite swish and quite posh. So yeah, the only downside with making chocolate, I actually went to the chocolate festival in Bristol last weekend, and that was eye-opening, and I'll probably try and exhibit there next season, because people are just going there literally to buy chocolate, nothing else, and all the stands there are chocolate and that's it. I mean, I spent a fortune just buying loads of different chocolate. There was no one doing raw chocolate. So, yeah, I make raw chocolate. I make it. I'm not into doing, like, all these health bars or whatever, because there's a lot of other people doing that. So I'm making it a bit more posh chocolate. So it's what I mean, my favourite is the coconut one. So it's all very dark, bitter, but I'm sweetening it with agave. And, like, my favourite one's the coconut one. It is better than a Bounty, without a shadow of a doubt. And then I've just perfected, I've been working on this one for a long time, is a Milky Bar, and I've done it with coconut cream. And trying to get anything liquid to set with chocolate is quite an issue. So I've sussed that one now without having to put any nasty things in it to make it set. So yeah, I'm looking forward to getting out on the market and selling chocolate. You know, and that's great fun as well because you meet loads of people there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that because it seems to me, as you know, I've been having a bit of truck with the Chocolate Love Temple on the Glastonbury High Street and the people that run that, and they've really turned me on to chocolate, sort of hot chocolate elixir, cold chocolate drinks, all manner of things. And one of the things that's really struck me about their particular enterprise, and in fact, Duncan admitted it when he came on the show. He said, that's our guys, he said. It's how they get people in, and people really want to talk over chocolate.
Absolutely. You get the occasional person go, oh, I can't eat chocolate. Oh, no, it gives me a headache. But generally, everybody loves chocolate. Most people love chocolate. So you can always tempt people to have a sample. And generally, once they've tasted it, they're quite up for buying it. Yeah, the hot chocolate drink thing is something that I'm going to look into. I need to get one of these big flasky things that you can push the top and it comes out, because I have made some really nice hot chocolate. Although with the raw organic thing, my favourite hot chocolate is with tin milk in it. So I'm not a proper vegan or anything in that, you know, I don't eat raw food all the time and stuff. I do try and eat healthily, but yeah, I mean, the hot chocolate that I've made with, I even condensed my own milk, so it was an organic rather than the tin version, and that is just lush. And I think if you have, well, for me, when I have a hot chocolate in the morning, I'll be buzzing till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It does give you that dopamine rush, and it keeps you going for the day. Absolutely.
It seems to me that Duncan and True at the Chocolate Love Temple, they seem to more or less live off chocolate during the day.
Yeah, I can see why. I mean, I do. The days that I'm selling it, definitely, because I generally wake up too late to have breakfast, so I'll just have a hot chocolate, get that down my neck and grab my stuff, chuck it in the car and get to market. And then, yeah, I'm just eating chocolate all day, so I'm buzzing all day. And it's just more alert and happy.
And isn't there a huge difference between the raw chocolate and the so-called chocolate we get from people like Mr. Cadbury and his ilk?
Yeah, it's very, very different. It's very different. I mean, even the posh brands of really nice chocolate. I mean, the milky one that I've been working on, I really like the taste of green and blacks, the kind of in-between dark and milk, the one that they do. And that was the kind of taste that I was aiming for. Green and blacks disillusioned me a little bit when they sold out to Cadbury's, which are owned by Kraft, so yeah, I mean, there are some other brands out there. The one other brand that I am very respectful of is Willy's Cacao. I think that guy, he should have a medal for the work that he's done in the chocolate industry. I don't know if people have heard of him. He did have a TV show on Channel 4 a few years ago. But basically, he'd gone out travelling to Venezuela as a young man and saw a chocolate farm for sale. He came back to London, sold his flat, and went back to Venezuela and has since planted all organic trees. He's making some lovely chocolate. And it is proper, nice quality chocolate. And he's even bought out a milk bar, which is lovely. So hats off to him for doing what he's done. And, you know, he must have been in debt for years over that. So
do you find yourself mixing with a lot of chocolate makers then?
Just starting to. I think going to the festival last week was opened a lot of doors. I met quite a few people. There was a fudge lady that was very interested in what I was doing. I had a big chat with her. She wants to connect up with me. There was another guy who was very helpful. Who said, email me, here's my card, and I can put you in touch with there's a really nice little artisan market in Bath, apparently, that would like to sell chocolate. So, yeah.
Well, that's really grand, isn't it? To say this was, I guess, your idea to try and turn what passes for a bit of money. Is it helping you out that way?
I'm breaking even. I'm not making at the moment, but then I've only been doing it a few months and I've had to pay out a lot. I've had some nice labels and things like that done. So I wouldn't say I was earning particularly anything from it at the moment, but I can see in the future that it will. the next step up, I'm going to keep doing stalls and keep it fairly small for the time being. But the next step up would then to be getting it into shops. But at the moment, I can't compete with the bigger brands that are in the shops. So I need to keep it out of the shops for at least another year. Although I've had offers from 3 or 4 little deli shops already. So
I guess that provide a bit of kind of regular income to support the market trade.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I mean, it supports my music career because, I mean, that's touch and go, whether you're ever going to make any money. DJing, it's very hard to make money unless you're in that big stream of megabucks. So, yeah, I mean, it's supporting me, it's supporting my kids, and it's seeing us through, basically. So, yeah.
I guess to a certain extent, the fact that Green and Black's got bought by Cabri and Cabri get bought by Kraft and stuff, that's perhaps making room at the bottom for more new specialist makers.
Yeah, I guess it is in a way. I guess it is. I mean, and the thing is, I mean, if you're going to... What I was taught about business is that you set up a business and you build it up and then you flog it on to a big corporation. So in the field of business, I don't suppose Green and Black's have done anything wrong. However, it's where your ethics lie, isn't it? I mean, I'd rather pass it on to my children than sell it out. I mean, let's say I become massively successful and I get offers from Cadbury's or whatever to buy it. I'm not sure that I would. I mean, it would depend, obviously, on where I am at that point in the future and how much money they were offering me and how much of that money I could do good things with. If I was ever to be in the position of suddenly having a lot of money, I would look around to see where I could help things. You know, I'd be up for making films, I'd be up for supporting other musicians, I'd be up for sharing big time. So, you know, if it came to that, then it would having to weigh up, have I got a business here to leave to my children, or have I got something, would it be more beneficial for everybody involved to sell it out for a huge amount of money and let's help lots more people? I guess it just depends on what happens in the future, doesn't it?
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because it seems to me to be, that again seems to be one of the nubs of the problem, is that the money, which we know doesn't exist anyway, is used to lure people who've done a really good job effectively out of the market. So one way or the other, you might well have had at one stage, say, some drinkable colas of one sort or another that were maybe nothing like so damaging as the ones that are mass-produced, but bit by bit, they all get bought up by the same people and nobody turns up to replace them at the lower end. Like, so it's a hard thing. And I mean, it's everything that seems to happen to it. Happens to farms, it happened to Skype, it happened to Google, you know, all these brilliant ideas which are one way or the other at some point transferred into the hands of corporations.
Yeah, I mean, if I was to think about Mummy's Yummy Chocolate being sold off to, you know, I think I'm not sure I could do it, to be honest. I'm not sure it would sit right with me, and it's like, are they going to put sugar in instead of nice things? And I'd probably make so many rules within the contract that they probably wouldn't want to do it, you know, because they say like Burt's Bees creams and beauty products, they sold out, and then the big company that bought them changed all the ingredients, and it's like, well, for what, you know, they had a really good product, one of their products really children's eczema, and then they changed the ingredients in that and it didn't solve the problem with the eczema anymore, so it's quite frustrating. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, from a business point of view and business making money and all of that, yeah, I understand it. It just depends where your ethics lie, isn't it, and what feels right at the time, I guess.
Yeah. What about the markets? Are you finding people there who are finding their own way and coming up with unique and interesting ideas that they can sell to people?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people that are just trying out lots of things to see if they work or not, but there's some really creative stuff on markets. I mean, I was in a market in Nailsea, a small town not far from here, a few weeks ago, and there was a lady there and she was making like padded covers for iPads. So, you know, if it's sticking out your handbag, nobody's likely to say, oh, that's an iPad, I might swipe it, because it just looks like a bit of funky material. So little things like that, and it was padded so it would save it through a drop, I guess. Yeah, I mean, there's lots of creative things going on, and there's amazing creative people. There's one guy on one market, I thought he had a really good idea. He'd bagged up, he sold chai and various different kinds of tea, and he'd bagged up, so it looked like a tobacco pouch, but it was full of chai. And then on the fold over, instead of having a packet of Rizzlers, it was a packet of tea bags. So you made your own little tea bags with them. And I thought that was really clever, you know. And I bought some, and I haven't used it all, but I just think every time I have friends around, I'm like, look at this chai. Look, you can make your own tea bags. And it's just the point of something else to talk about and a bit of fun to do and get the kids shoving tea in tea bags and making their own cups of tea with it and stuff, you know. So, yeah, I mean, there's loads going on. And I actually met a few of my guests from my show through the market. So, yeah, it was all good. And the people generally that have market stalls are really nice. I'd always wondered about it, and since I've got into it, I've met some really lovely people, and they all do seem pretty awake as well, you know.
Yeah, and are the markets kind of alive round Bristol and the area?
God, yeah, there's loads. There's loads going on. Yeah, there's markets all over the place. I think if once you tap into it and you get involved, I'm receiving emails now for all sorts of things. Things that I didn't even realise were going on, you know. And what's the other one? I had to turn it down because the thing is with chocolate in the summer, you can't really sell chocolate in the summer. It just melts. And unless you've got an electric supply and a fridge and the rest of it, I think it's just a bit too tricky. So, yeah, one of the guys at the chocolate festival last week, he did say it is more of a seasonal thing, like Christmas and Easter. But then that frees me up for the summer to do music, doesn't it? So I think actually I've got it pretty sussed at the moment. Yeah.
And I suppose you can always do the hot chocolate elixir. Mind you, if it's in the winter, summer, you can do those nice chocolate drinks or something, I guess. But again, it needs to be cool, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, I think, I mean, you could do chocolate drinks quite easily, actually, because if it melts, it doesn't matter. You're mixing it with water or milk or whatever you're mixing it with. Put it in a big flask with a couple of ice cubes, you'd be well away. So, yeah, good thinking. And hot chocolate, yeah, I think you could do that anywhere, really. You know, hot chocolate doesn't matter if it melts then, does it? Just bunging it in a drink and blitzing it up. So, yeah, I'm sure there's kitchens that would let you at festivals that would let you borrow their blitzer for a few minutes.
Yeah, I guess there's probably a bit of an outlet at the festivals as well, perhaps.
Yeah, maybe I should look into doing like a chocolate drink thing. That would be quite good.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you what, shall we play a couple of tunes so that we can have a refreshment break and come back in sort of 9 or 10 minutes or so?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really brilliant. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on peoplesinternetradio.com, and I'm talking with Libby Laws, which is really great. So thanks for being with us, Libby.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure.
Hopefully I've still got Libby on the line. Can you hear me, Libby?
Yeah, loud and clear.
Absolutely brilliant. So you're going to be playing at the Green Gathering later in the year, and you're going to be at the Beltane gig as well?
Yeah, I'm the fire master, and I'm the fire starter.
Has anybody outlined to you what the fire master's responsibilities are?
You'll have to start the fire and keep it in all weekend.
Excellent. Well, that'll keep you busy.
Yeah, yeah. I said, well, I'm going to have some men to come and help me carry the logs.
I'm happy to give you a bit. You know me, I'm happy to give you a bit of a hand keeping things are burning.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll be fine. I mean, I love starting fires and I have an open fire here fairly regularly. So I know what I'm doing and I don't get really faced anymore. So I'm fairly responsible. So hopefully it'll all be good.
And what about the broadcasting? I've really missed hearing your voice, and I especially enjoyed the talks you had with the musicians from the dance era, because it's not something I knew anything about at all. Are we going to be hearing you again on the airwaves, do you think?
Yeah, I've got a show actually coming up on Good Friday, so that's April the 18th, and I'll be interviewing Mark Passio. I'm really looking forward to that. I only came across him a few months ago, and I heard him talk to Stephen on Cancel the Cabal last night, and I really love what he's saying, and I love the way he presents his information and the whole good luck with that. You know, he's so cool. I really, really admire him. So I'm really looking forward to that. I'm not sure if he's used to something as eclectic as what I'm going to put on there. But yeah, it'll be an interesting show for definite. So it's going to be on Good Friday. I'm not sure. It's going to be 4 p.m. Eastern time, which since we've had the British summertime thing, I'm not sure if that's 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock in English time. So I need to look into that. But yeah, Good Friday night. I'll be spinning some tunes and talking to Mark Passio. So yeah, that'll be good. And I have really missed the show, actually. I don't miss the stress. I mean, I'm sure you appreciate that, having had technical issues this evening and last week. So that side of it, I don't really miss at all. It is very stressful. But yeah, I mean, again, I met some fantastic people and connected into this little community, which are all lovely, you know. So it's good. And we're sharing ideas and we're seeking solutions. And that can only be a good thing. So
who's your favourite person to talk to?
Oh, definitely you, Doc.
Oh, thank you, Libby.
No, I think everybody. I think everybody I interviewed, I enjoyed talking to. It was so diverse. I mean, I had gardeners, I had hash oil makers, I had Bitcoin people, I had Chris Evrard was a really good person to talk to. And then there was the one with Dr. Fox, wasn't there, with the Tory politician. That was a bit of a laugh.
Yeah, I heard all of those shows that you just mentioned, and you're right, they really were very different from each other. I enjoyed all of them, but I didn't envy you bearding the beast in his lair, as it were. What was it like talking to your actual politician?
It was quite scary, to be honest. At first, when I went in there, I was only given such a short time span with him. And then he was 5-10 minutes late. So, I mean, I only had about 15 minutes with him in total. And because I got quite a few questions prepared to ask him, and people were saying to me on Facebook and stuff, give him shit and go on, tear his hair out and all the rest of it. And I thought, well, I want to hear his answers for all of these questions. So I didn't want to argue back. And it wasn't until really the chemtrail, because he was so nice and smiley, and he was looking at me directly in the eyes, and he's got these nice clear blue eyes, and, you know, but he was just telling me lies and bullshit. It wasn't until the chemtrail question, really. I think I upset him a bit when I said about piling into Libya, and that put him in line for becoming a war criminal. And he said, everything in that question is wrong. You know, I think that was the bit where he started to realise actually what I was about. And then when I asked him the chemtrail question, and he was just, no, they don't exist. No, they don't. And I just, the penny suddenly dropped that actually this guy is just lying through his teeth to me, you know. And part of me wanted to just go, stop fucking lying. Do you know what I mean? And then I was like, no, keep it together, keep it together.
Yeah, well, I think you took a sensible approach there. You had a limited amount of time, and I thought the questions were pretty simple. And it was a real eye-opener to hear a politician answering the questions that we actually want to hear asked, because you just don't get that on mainstream radio.
No, well, nobody's asking those questions, are they? And because he is my MP, I thought, well, what an opportunity. Let's just go for it, you know. So, yeah, I got all suited and booted. I even put makeup on. And I just think, I mean, God knows what he made of me. Not that I really care anyway, but it's just, I think I did rattle him a little bit. And the other kind of spooky thing was, there was another man in the room that he came with, who just introduced himself as John. Is it okay if I sit and listen? And I said, yeah, as long as you don't make a noise. You know, and who was he? Was he his lover? Was he like a CIA MI5 bod? Was he, you know, was he just a mate? I don't know. So, yeah, interesting. And then he shook my hand at the end and said goodbye, and that was that. And I was like shunted out of the room. But, yeah, I legged it down the road and just got in the car and drove off as quickly as possible. It was quite an experience, let's put it that way.
Well, one of the questions that amazed me was when you asked him what he thought about the truth movement, and he basically said, what truth movement?
I know, and I loved it when Chris Everard went, oh, yeah, that's why, what was it, the CIA have spent 15 grand on it, 15 million or whatever it was, 150 million, I don't know. Yeah, I mean, Chris Everard is a fantastic source of information. His brain holds everything. You know, I said to him a couple of weeks ago, I want to take some monatomic gold so I can remember everything like you. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I seem to have a trail coming out of the back of my head. As new information comes in, old information goes out. I don't have that ability to retain lots of information, which is why perhaps I'm not the best person to argue with politicians. It's not my thing in life, really. But somebody like Chris Everard, I mean, I'd like to see him go up against a politician. I mean, that would just be awesome.
I think it's fair to say that if we could organise it so that any of our best people were to run into any of their best people, we would have an interesting debate.
Oh, it'd be phenomenal. Can you imagine that on Question Time? If all of us lot were in the audience or something. Excuse me, what about the GMO? And, excuse me. You know, that'd be great. But, you know, on these programmes, the questions are filtered and you're not allowed to ask questions. You have to hand your questions in first. So, yeah, it's a tricky one, isn't it? But, yeah, it would be really good. I mean, I think everybody should go and visit their MP and ask the awkward questions and record it and then put it on YouTube or on Facebook or wherever, you know, wherever your social networking. I think that's because the minute that politicians realise that their answers are being broadcast internationally, it might make them sharpen up a little bit. And it also, you know, when they hear people like Chris responding to them, what I loved about Chris was when I talked about the money and do we need to change the money system? And he was saying, no, we need to stay within our means. And then Chris Everard comes up with the MP, Mr. Pickles, who spent 50 grand on biscuits, you know. I was just holding my sides laughing. So yeah, I had to press my mute button while I had a good old chuckle at that. But yeah, you know. Put somebody like Chris or someone like Mark Passio up against a politician. I'm sure that the politicians would start to behave differently, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure. And I think you're absolutely right there. Do you have any plans to try and interview any more of them?
I've thought about it. I'm not sure whether Dr. Vox will have me back or not, but as he's my MP, he is obliged to see me. Whether he heard the show or not, I don't know. And I'm kind of a little bit fearful of going back and asking. Just because, well, you know, it was a bit naughty, wasn't it, really? So I don't know. I mean, I will go and visit him again at some point. It would be nice to... I kind of would really like to have a conversation with a politician or a banker and have them be honest back, you know, and just say, look, this is the deal. This is how we feel. What can we do to change it? What can we do? Let's have negotiations. You know, let's open up tables for negotiation. So, but I mean, as it stands at the moment, that's not going to happen. I was talking to David Lim, the chemtrail guy, just a few weeks ago, and I said, why don't we go to Parliament and see if we could talk there? Because you can. Anybody who's a British citizen can go to Parliament and make a 10-minute speech or a 5-minute speech. How many politicians would be there and listening? Nobody knows, probably not very many. They'd probably all be down the bar. But, I mean, that's a good start, I think, and let's get our voices heard because, you know, like Vim was saying... something's got to be done and we need to start doing it soon. I don't want to. I mean, just looking at what's going on in America now, I think we're only about 2 years behind what's going on in America. If you looked at what was going on in America a couple of years ago, things are very similar here now. So, yeah, I mean, what's going on in America? I just saw on Natural News tonight that there's a ranch in America, in Nevada, I think, that the American government have decided they want the land back and they've auctioned off all the cattle and they've sent an army down there with helicopters and armed soldiers and God knows what for a family, that they're farmers. Do you know what I mean? What the hell is going on when that's, you know, it's beyond credibility that it would even happen. What's illegal about having land that's been passed down through generation, and that you're farming cattle. How can that be illegal? How can that be wrong?
Yeah, things do seem to be gathering pace, don't they? And I think one of the things that concerns me about stories like that is how the rest of us are just looking the other way, almost, you know, well, so long as it doesn't happen to me, and it, you know, there are people who seem to believe this idea that if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to worry about.
Well, no, I disagree with that. I mean, I've got nothing to hide, but I've come into bother just from opening my mouth, you know, like going to hold a banner up to the Queen and whatever. That, God, the hassle that the police gave me because I've got a piece of rolled up paper under my arm.
What did it say, your piece of rolled up paper?
Well, it didn't say anything because I knew I'd been through the law thing with commonly known as Dom. And if I put anything in words, I could have been arrested for intent of causing mental distress. So I racked my brains. I sat up till about 2 o'clock in the morning thinking, what can I write? And then I just thought symbology. So I did a pyramid with the third eye at the top, with some bricks falling out at the bottom, with some dead babies from Palestine. And then I had the Queen with no crown, sort of near the top of the pyramid. And then on top of that, I did a bright red Star of David. And then on top of that, I did the yellow Freemason. What's the thing? They've got the yellow thing that makes like a diamond shape.
Oh, the square and compass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was it. And yeah, they called me over at one point and said, we've received information to say you've got things in your pocket that you intend to throw at the Queen's car, so therefore we're detaining you to go through your pockets. I had nothing in my pockets. I'd given it all to Dom. The only thing I had was a packet of tobacco and a packet of chocolate, because I thought if I get arrested, then I want some fags and chocolate, really. what else do you need in jail? And because I'd never been arrested before, I think Dom was quite interested to see if I did get arrested, how long it would be before they threw me out without me giving my name. I didn't get arrested. They couldn't arrest me. They did take the picture off me, and they were talking in walkie-talkies and going, it's got dead babies at the bottom. But I did spray them with gold so they looked like cherubs. You know, it was all just a bit of a laugh, really. But I held it up to the Queen before all of that kicked off. I know that she saw it. And I know that on the way out, after they let me go, I ran to the barrier as the car was leaving and held it up. And I know that Prince Philip saw it. So, yeah, it's all a bit of a laugh, isn't it? I think all these things, if you're going to do them, you've got to do them with a sense of humour. There's no point in getting angry. Because, I mean, if I'd have got angry at that stage, I would have been nicked. And I think it's a game, isn't it? Let's see how far we can push it without getting nicked. So, yeah, I got out of there. And they did follow us back to the car, and the guy probably got my number plate, so they could identify me in the end. But, yeah, and, yeah, so what? Again, I've got nothing to hide. So this whole nothing to hide thing, I think people are going to – I think the people in this country that are going to start to feel things soon will be the middle classes. I mean, the lower end have already felt it. We've got the bedroom tax and the rest of it. We're already feeling it. The middle class are the next to be well, I think some of them are already starting to feel it, you know, in that their mortgages are going up and the food's going up and all of that. It is gradually creeping up the ladder, so everybody's going to start feeling it soon. And how they react to it is going to be interesting. But we do need some really clever people on board. You know, we can't just have loads of argy-bargy going on, because that will just bring in more and more stringent control. We need intelligent negotiation, in my opinion.
Yeah, especially being as your trolls and your Delphi technicers and common purpose people really want to generate argy-bargy, don't they?
Absolutely, absolutely. Which is why sense of humour. Just, you know, when I get trolled, generally I just, if I'll either totally ignore it or I'll just take the piss out of them, you know, depending on what mood I'm in, really. I think ignoring them totally is the way forward, because then they've got nowhere to go. They've got, the minute you react to a troll, they're coming back at you, and they're getting nastier and nastier with every comment. So if you don't even give them that scope, then where have they got to go? Just ignore them. Totally ignore them. If it's on Facebook, block them. If it's on YouTube, just ignore it. And that's the best advice I can give, really, on in my experience. If you're being trolled or there's trolls in chat rooms and whatever, just ignore them. And if there's people there that you want to talk to, then go through the PM boxes rather than the open talking, and then people can't troll you, can you know?
Yeah, yeah, I guess because it is attention seeking as well on their part, isn't it? And it does seem to me that trying to ask them gentle questions seems to make them a lot more more angry and difficult as well.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of them, they're not that bright either. So if you really get into an argument with them, you can generally have them pretty quickly. But who's got the time and energy? They are just energy saps. So don't even bother giving them the energy.
So it's a bit like the system itself, really. We want to deprive it of the energy we're giving it, and then it can no longer turn on us.
Exactly. I mean, Chris Everard was talking about, I went on his show on the Truth Frequency Radio, and we talked about how to become an MEP and how to become an MP. And generally, if you want to become an MP, it costs you £500. If you want to become an MEP, it costs you £5,000. And if you get a percentage of votes, I think it's 2% if you're an MEP, and I can't remember for an MP. If you get a certain percent, you'll get that money back. So if you've got a lot of support in your area, go for it, you know. Or get out there and find that support. And then let's get into, I mean, this is Chris's theory, let's loads of us get into Parliament, just say no to everything and cause arguments by saying no. That's one way. I mean, imagine if a load of truthers were in Parliament. It would be quite amusing, wouldn't it? Can you imagine Bez?
It'd certainly be great. All we need to do is get... But the thing is, I guess, that it means involving yourself in a system where people have to be on the electoral roll, and when they vote for you, they're voting for whoever wins anyway, and all that kind of stuff. Do you think that that we'd be helping ourselves by endeavouring to become politicians?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was listening to Mark Passio last night, and he was saying that the awakening is less than 1% of the world, which I thought was a little bit depressing if that's the actual statistic, because, I mean, pretty much now all of my social circle are pretty much awake. Even if they're not actively involved, they know what's going on. And so to say that it's less than 1% of the world, I don't know. I mean, that's quite a low figure, isn't it? So what difference can that few of us really do? So if we're stuck in this system and we're going to have to put up with this system, then maybe it would work, because that is one way to change things. But I think we need to do it en masse. Everything we do, we need to do en masse with a lot of people. One person standing up, shouting, you know, you're just a freak. Whereas if there's 10 of you, I mean, there's that whole psychological thing. If one person does something, then they're the freak. The minute somebody else joins in with them, then they become socially acceptable. So if there's more than one of us doing something, then there's possibilities. But I don't see a lot of hope for just one person doing something.
No, it's very difficult. It's very difficult, isn't it? Because it seems to me that it's entirely being supported by our labour and the money, the meaningless promissory tokens that we hand over to them without question. Do you think that, because there seems to be a pair of schools of thought on whether or not we need to see the system go in its entirety, or whether we can use it and make it work properly, because, you know, it seems to me that it does have the elements to do that.
I think it does have the elements. However, let's not forget that it was designed to be this way. So it's not actually a broken system. It's a very successful working system for the people at the top. Just because it doesn't benefit the rest of the people doesn't mean to say it's not working. So looking at it from like a slightly different angle, can you fix something that's not broken? What's the point? So, I mean, the rebel in me goes, yeah, tear it all down, let's start again. That's what I would like to see. I would like to see soldiers putting their guns down. I'd like to see policemen handing, just putting their tasers on the floor and joining people. That's what I'd like to see. Whether that happens in my lifetime, I don't know. I think that's the stage we need to get to. Like Mark Passio was saying last night, that's when we know there's a full-on global awakening, is when the soldiers and police put their guns down and refuse to take orders. having talked to recently, well, last year, having talked to a load of young boys that had just signed up, I felt very disillusioned. You know, most of them were there because they could only see a future of debt or being in the army. They couldn't see beyond who they were actually working for. You know, I felt very sorry for them, these young boys. They were 17 and they're going to sign up because they didn't want to have a life of debt.
And I'm like, same sort of age as you. You left home to become a model.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so looking back, I mean, I felt very protective over these boys after a short time of talking to them. But I also felt there wasn't a lot of, I mean, some of them, a couple of them were not very bright. I'm like, I want to go and kill people. I'm like, fine, I don't want to talk to you. But I mean, a couple of them were really intelligent, and it was just circumstance that the reason that they were there was circumstance. And it's like, fine, can you not find the strength to not join up? Because until people stop joining up, wars are always going to be fought. You know, I think Einstein or somebody clever said that. You know, while angry young men and women are signing up, then there's always going to be wars. That is the key to breaking down the system. And I will post, I'd post regularly on police sites and military sites and get ridiculed a lot and get in a lot of arguments. But generally, just put lots of LOLs and smiley faces and, you know, get out of there pretty quickly when it gets nasty. But, you know, everyone's got their own opinion. Everyone's entitled to their own opinion. But we know that what's going on is wrong, and trying to explain that to some people with the brainwashing that's going on, it's so frustrating sometimes. It makes me want to cry. You know, just talking to friends sometimes, trying to explain stuff, I just feel like I'm going to cry because I can just see that they don't get where I'm coming from. It's so frustrating, you know. It makes me either want to scream, shout and break things or just burst into tears because, oh, my God. It's pretty urgent, you know. I don't want to be bringing my kids up in a police state. Who does?
Yeah, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because so much stuff is so clear to us. I mean, it's clear to me that any soldier that's gone and fought in Iraq or Afghanistan or even, you know, probably even Vietnam and stuff has actually been seriously screwed over by their own commanders and strategists and stuff. They're getting poisoned, their children are being poisoned, you know, they're using plutonium tipped bullets and stuff, which means that, you know, everybody, friend and foe alike, is getting affected by what's effectively a nuclear weapon. I think that's what it's classified as, but it's being used anyway. Yet presumably the people that are joining the army are completely clear of this sort of information.
Well, it's like people saying, why are the pilots doing the chemtrails? It's because, I mean, in my opinion, I think that they've been told that they're saving the world and they think that they're doing a good thing.
So yeah, the compartmentalisation thing where you only know a little bit about what you're doing and it's not enough to tell you, really.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, sorry to keep banging on about what Mark Passio said last night. His main message was, just keep talking. It's our duty and our responsibility, and the reason why we're here and the reason why so many of us feel compelled to do what we're doing, and certainly why I do, I just feel compelled to tell everybody, just keep talking. You know, there was a big thing a year or so ago where it's like, oh, those people, they don't need to wake up. It's not their journey. Well, that's part of the New Age bullshit thing, isn't it? Yes, they do need to wake up. And yes, I will kick people up the arse, you know, verbally. I can't help it.
I think keep on talking's a really good message to put across, you know, in closing. And I tend to agree with you. I've thought several times, you know, since starting doing the radio show and the talks and all that, I've just taken to the woods and putting my back against a tree. But you can't. I just can't. Can't know what's going on, can't listen to people suffering around me and not try to help, you know, because we've got solutions to so many of these things. Yeah. You know,
yeah, I mean, it's like one of the ladies at the Southwest Against Nuclear, she was saying, imagine if everybody on the council estate in every part of Britain knew that there was a free energy source, like that she was talking about the Tesla technology. And can you imagine what would happen if everybody realised that you didn't have to pay for your energy? I mean, it's only through information and talking to people. So I talk to the window cleaner, I talk to the people in the street, I talk to the people in the bakers, I talk to the people in the butchers, I talk to the, you know, I talk to everybody. And I'm sure I'm a source of, like, I'm some eccentric, freaky kind of woman that lives in this town. However, I know that I'm not alone, and I know that there's still people in this town that agree with me. So while I've got that, okay, I'm not totally on my own. I have got people that I can call up, or I've done this and I feel a bit stupid or whatever. You know, I've got backing up. I know that there's people back me up. So that's really comforting that I'm not on my own. You know, I think it's when you feel, oh my God, I'm really on my own and everyone's against me. That's when you just want to curl up and play video games and do nothing. So
you never know when something you say to somebody is going to have an effect a little bit further down the line.
Sure. I mean, I know that I've affected quite a few people, and that I can't say I've woken people up, but I've definitely made people think, you know, just by chucking in, sowing seeds, just little comments here and there. And the kind of town that I live in as well, it's quite acceptable to join in people's conversations in shops, which I love about here. It's one of the reasons why I moved here. You can just join in with other people's conversations in the shopping queue and whatever. And I constantly tell people in the supermarket queue as well, did you know that product that you've got there, it's got aspartame in it, and aspartame can do this, that and the other, and, you know, but it's trying to say to people, that's the reason that you're drinking that is why you're fat. I can't be that blatant without upsetting people. So it's finding a way around and trying to show that you're helping people and you're not just being a rude cow, you know.
And I guess some of that comes from the humour as well, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, you've got to do it with humour. Otherwise you just upset people. So, yeah.
Well, that's really brilliant. Thank you very much, Libby. I think we should give ourselves a good 30 minutes to play some of your music now.
Cool, thank you.
And perhaps you come back on the show with me at one of these festivals we're at, because we normally do a show from them on the Thursday night. So perhaps when we're sharing a field, we can share a mic.
Yeah, that would be brilliant fun.
Excellent stuff. Well, don't go missing from the radio, eh? It's really nice to hear your voice again.
No, well, I'm back on Good Friday, and thank you very much for inviting me on. It's been lovely.
Brilliant. At last, a good reason to call Good Friday, Good Friday.